Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Time Magazine is out with another provocative cover story, this one asking if we're now facing the end of the age of excess. Very, very interesting. Kurt Anderson, writing for Time Magazine, begins by asking whether this crisis, this economic crisis, is really good for America, because it's going to change some kind of moral structure for us concerning the difference between not enough, enough, and too much. Now, I think his article raises a host of issues. I think the Time Magazine cover story is one of those cultural symbols of our particular time that really puts right in our face the big question, how do we know when enough is enough? How do we know when too much is more than enough? How would you define an age of excess? It's very interesting. Kurt Anderson defines it by such things as disposable income and savings, consumer kind of markers. Here's one. Listen to this. Meanwhile, over the time of this last economic boom, Americans on average gained about a pound a year, so that an adult of a given age is now at least 20 pounds heavier than someone back then being the 1970s. It's going to be very interesting for us to ask this question, and from a Christian worldview perspective, I have to tell you, this is one that makes us think. How would we determine the difference between enough and too much? How would we answer Time Magazine's question, is this crisis good for America? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about whether or not we're facing the end of an age of excess and how we would define that on the Albert Mohler Program. We're glad to hear from you. Just follow us, Mohler Radio at twitter.com. The Albert Mohler Program at Facebook. You can always email us at mail@albertmohler.com. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll get to that topic in just a moment. In the media, there is so much conversation these days about so many things, it's hard sometimes to differentiate between the important and the unimportant, but every once in a while, in the most unexpected place in the paper, something just hits you between the eyes. That's what happened to me yesterday. In Sunday's edition of the New York Times, under the Modern Love column, I'll admit that's not a column I have generally looked at, but there, in a part of the paper where you might least expect to find a great worldview issue lurking, I found this Modern Love column written by Margaret Gunther. The title of it, My Clock Was Already Ticking. Now, in it, she writes about the fact that she, as a younger woman, wanted a child. She wanted a baby. And in this case, she found herself pregnant, and the man she was living with that she had hoped to marry was not interested in having a baby. And so, as it turned out, when he found out that she was pregnant, as Margaret Gunther points out in her article, it became her problem, not their problem. And so far as the man was concerned, the answer to her problem was an abortion, and she had an abortion. And now she writes about looking back. She writes, and just listen to this, when you think about the abortion controversy in America, so often it's really politicized into two opposing camps over the pro-choice issue, Roe v. Wade, and all the rest. And inevitably, that's so, because inevitably we're talking about the legal, legislative, judicial, and social policies put in place that have made the tragedy of abortion all too common. But listen to this from the personal perspective, and just listen to the way this woman is writing, because she had an abortion. She obviously is defending her right to have an abortion, but she's asking the question about what really happened there. Listen to what she writes. She says, on the day of the abortion, I kept envisioning myself getting up off the table at the last moment before the procedure. I knew what I was doing was wrong, not ethically, but personally, spiritually wrong. My deepest fear, what if this is it? And by that question, she meant, what if I'm not able to have another baby? I want to read one sentence here, because here in this Modern Love column of the New York Times, I think we find, embedded like a landmine in the middle of a children's park, the kind of explosive statement that really ought to have our attention. She says, on the day of the abortion, I kept envisioning myself getting up off the table at the last moment before the procedure, period. Listen to the next sentence. I knew what I was doing was wrong. Not ethically, but personally, spiritually wrong. Now let's assume for the moment that we don't know anything about a moral code. We don't know anything about the definition of life and death. We really don't even know anything about abortion. All we know is what this woman has told us. Somehow, in her mind, something can be ethically okay and personally and spiritually wrong. Okay, here is one of the keys that we need to think about when we think about why the Christian worldview is different than all other worldviews. The Christian worldview is the one worldview that understands the unity of all truth in the existence of the one true and living God. And the unity of all truth means that we are the people who know that nothing can be morally right if it's spiritually wrong. But think about that other word she uses here. She says, personally. She's talking here about terminating a human life, and she seems to embed, even in her article, the fact that she understands this is a hugely important, even tragic decision. As a matter of fact, it turns out she is not able to conceive after this. It turns out that this pregnancy was the very last pregnancy that was really her opportunity. The title of her article was "My Clock Was Already Ticking," and she's really talking about the regret that comes into her life at that point, even though she's now the happy adoptive mother along with her current husband of two boys. But she writes about that abortion that she had, and she says, "I knew what I was doing was wrong, not ethically, but personally, spiritually wrong." You see, the Christian worldview reminds us that God has determined what is right and wrong, not just because of some arbitrary decision he has made to say this list is right and that list is wrong, but because what makes something morally right is the fact that it is to God's glory, and because it is to God's glory, it is for our good. This word she uses personally here implies that abortion is no more than a matter of personal morality. You think it's right, I think it's wrong. She thinks it's wrong, he thinks it's right. But when you're talking about life and death, and she even seems to understand, she has to understand, we're talking here about life and death, the word personally just really doesn't even matter here, other than how we personally are going to come to terms with the fact that abortion is the termination of a living human being. When you see something like this in the newspaper, when you hear something like this in the cultural conversation, let it serve as a reminder of the fact that the Christian worldview comes again and again and again right in front of us as believers in Christ to remind us that we do not have any option of saying, I believe that this is wrong for me, but right for you, when it comes to a matter of objective reality, such as the moral status of an unborn human child. It might be right for you and wrong for someone else to buy this particular dress at this moment. It might be right for you and wrong for someone else to buy that particular car at this moment. It might be right for you and wrong for someone else to take this job at this certain time. But it can't be right for you and wrong for someone else to terminate an innocent human life. It's just the wrong category. I didn't expect to find something so illuminating in the Modern Love column of the New York Times, Sunday's edition, but there it was. She writes saying she believed that this was a betrayal of herself. Missing from this is that it was the betrayal of an unborn child. USA Today is out with a very interesting article saying that as much as we are now turning to the digital media for so much, we're spending so much time now looking at the screens of our computers and laptops and PDAs and iPhones and all the rest, it turns out that when it comes to watching video, the television is still the preferred medium of watching what goes for the kind of entertainment of a video format that is now ubiquitous. You have YouTube and all the rest. You have all this on the internet. You have the availability of all kinds of commercial programming. You got everything from Hulu to now Amazon.com offering video services. But at the end of the day, it still turns out that the small screen, as we have called television for so long, is where people watch television. So and watch video. And watch that kind of entertainment. The television is still king. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we are just dividing our time now between the television and the computer? No, it means, writ large, computer time is being added to television time, such that total screen time for most people is now over 8.5 hours a day. Did you hear that? There are only 24 hours in a day. And the average adult in America right now is spending 8.5 hours before a screen. Gary Levin, writing in USA Today, says that the study cited here from the Council for Research Excellence confirms similar findings in early reports, but uses a more statistically reliable method of observation. Researchers followed 476 people. They followed them for two 14-hour days and recorded all their media usage and daily activities. Now, here's my favorite part of the entire article in USA Today. It turns out that these studies have discovered that people are woefully wrong inaccurate, perhaps even dishonest, in relating how many hours they actually spend with the media. It turns out that most people underreport by a significant degree how much time they're actually spending on the screen, or on the keyboard, or at a screen. Very, very interesting. It turns out, by the way, that adults 65 and older are the primary audience for television now, spending far more time looking at the television by percentage than looking at the computer screen. We're going to come back to talk about whether or not we are now facing an age of excess at its end. Is that what this is all about? And how would we know? How would we define excess? Give me a call on the Albert Miller Program. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The age of excess. Very, very interesting. Is that what we've just passed through? Is that how we would rightly define the last several decades, particularly the time of the 80s and the 90s into the first decades of the 21st century? That's a big question being asked by a lot of people. Time magazine has a cover story and asks a big question. The end of excess, question mark, has a reset button right there in the very center of the cover, as if what we're experiencing right now and what Kurt Anderson, the author of that article, calls the Great Recession, what we are experiencing here is some kind of cultural reset. He's asking some basic questions, and I think he's onto something here. I want to ask the question to you today. How would you define excess? If that's what marks the last 25 or so years in our economy, if we have been engaged in a headlong pursuit of excess, if that age has now come to an end, how do we know the difference between what's enough and what's too much? Now, by the way, I don't think Kurt Anderson answers that letter, that question. I don't think he answers the very question that he raises in the cover story of this issue of Time magazine. But he puts out some fascinating stuff. I'll give him that. Listen to this. He writes about the fact that from 1980 to 2007, the median price of a new American home quadrupled. It didn't double, it didn't triple, it quadrupled in a period there of about 28 years. Then he says that disposable income in each household that was used to service mortgage and consumer debt increased 35%. Back in 1982, the average household saved 11% of its disposable income. By 2007, that was less than 1%. Fascinating there. So, you know, the average savings rate went down from 11% to 1%. And then he looks at the big cultural issue. He says the same worldview, the same mentality made gambling a big issue in the States until the late 1980s. You know, as much as I bemoan and consider tragic the spread of gambling, I, looking at this, was just reminded of how recent this is. Listen to this. Until the late 80s, only Nevada and New Jersey had casinos, but now 12 states do. And 48 states, that leaves only two, 48 states has some form of legalized betting. Kurt Anderson says, it's as if we decided that Mardi Gras and Christmas are so much fun, we ought to make them a year-round way of life. We started living large, literally as well as figuratively, he says, pointing out that the size of the average new home increased by about a half over that period. Meanwhile, speaking of living large, he writes, the average American gained about a pound a year, so that an adult of a given age is now at least 20 pounds heavier than someone the same age back in 1980. He goes on and writes, we saw what was happening for years, for decades, but we ignored it or shrugged it off, preferring to imagine that we weren't really headed over the falls. He writes about the fact that industries tried to tell us, popular culture tried to tell us, but we weren't listening. But now the Great Recession, and that's what he calls whatever this economic period we are now in, he calls it the Great Recession and says this now marks the end of excess. We are now in an age of some kind of new post-excess existence, and we're going to have to figure out what that looks like. Now, by the way, Kurt Anderson has a three-point plan. He says, you know, alcoholics may need a 12-point plan, but he has 3 points. Here are his three. This is the way he describes it, a streamlined, secularized, three-step program for America. Step number one, admit that we are powerless over addiction to easy money and cheap fossil fuel and living large, that our lives have become unmanageable. Do you agree with that point? Point number two, or step number two, believe that we can, individually and collectively, restore ourselves to sanity and normal living. Do you agree with step number two? Step number three, make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves and be entirely ready to remove our defects of character. Well, how's that for step three? Let me tell you about steps one, two, and three. If they mean anything, well, at least points two and three should be applicable at any time, at any given time. I can't imagine anyone would say, I have defects of character, but I'm not going to be concerned about them, or that I'm unwilling to restore myself to sanity and normal living. The problem is, lacking definition, that really doesn't mean anything. But I think he asked the right question. When you ask the question, the end of excess, question mark, you're asking something that we as Christians had better have a stake in, because we are not merely consumers. We're not merely marketers. We are not merely buyers and sellers. We're not merely economic beings. We are moral beings, and we are the ones called not merely to financial sanity. We're called to stewardship. So given the fact that we're called to stewardship, you know, given the fact that we are the people who are supposed to believe that everything belongs to God and that everything is supposed to be ultimately at God's disposal, if we're the people who are supposed to believe that everything we have and everything we own has come from God and belongs to God and is to be used for the glory of God, how do we know what is excess and what is not excess? This is not one of those questions that I offer here on the air intending to come back with a quick answer. I think this is one we're going to have to work at hard. I want to invite you to work with me. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is a tough one. I think there are a lot of folks out there who say, I'm not going to bite on that one. I'm not going to call on that question because, you know, after all, I'm not sure that there's an easy answer. This isn't a 2 plus 2 equals 4. This isn't, a question as whether murder is right or wrong. This is a question about how do we know the difference between enough and too much? Time magazine says that's America's moral issue. I think we need to answer the question. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Bedford, Texas. Candace is listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Candace.
Hi, Dr. Miller. I just wanted to make a comment that I think excess is when we buy into society's idea that we need more than what we're supposed to be content with. I guess if you understand one. So I don't know if anybody else made that comment.
And, you know, I appreciate, Candace, stick with me here if you can. I appreciate the fact that that you are trying to define this, and you're defining it as more society telling us that we need more than we should be content with. Let me ask you an honest question, Candace, and I'm putting you on the spot here, but I'm on the spot with you. How do we know how much is supposed to be enough to make us content?
that's a tough one, but I'm guessing that if you're happy with, if you're content with your family and what you have, be blessed that you have some place to live and that you have a job that keeps you from being out on the street, we shouldn't be going after, like, the pretty clothes and the big houses that are, frankly, just pointless of even striving for.
I appreciate your thought put into this, Candace. I really do. And since you use the word contentment, I am honor-bound to come back and say I think the New Testament tells us, the Apostle Paul being the example here, that we are to be content in whatsoever state we find ourselves. You know, Paul says he learned to be content when he was in prison, when he was free, when he had a lot, when he had nothing. And I know exactly what you're saying, Candace, and I think you're speaking for an awful lot of us when you say we ought to be content with less than what society tells us we need. I think the New Testament takes that further and says we need to be content even when we don't have anything. But I understand exactly what you're talking about here. There is this clear sense that society says, if you think you have enough, you're just not wanting enough. If you think you have enough, you just haven't seen the latest. If you think you have enough, you're going to hurt the economy by not buying the latest, the biggest, the bigger, the best, the new and improved. If you're not putting your kids here and dressing them like this, if you're not driving this or doing that, if you're not living in a house like this, you're just not doing well. Now, I don't think Kurt Anderson has an even barely adequate answer to his own question. But I do think this question is even more in our territory and more our responsibility than the average reader of Time magazine. I want to know what you think. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Are we at the end of excess? How would we know? 877-893-8255 is the phone number. We'll be right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, back when I was in seminary, I had a professor who said, here's the deal. The church needs to answer the questions the world is asking. The world gets to ask the questions. The church has to provide the answers. Now, I think that's about half right. Because I think there are times when the church has to ask the questions sometimes as well, has to pose some very awkward biblical questions to a society. But he was at least half right. And that is that when the world's asking a serious question, the church better be there with a very serious, biblical, distinctively Christian answer. When Time magazine asked the question, is this the end of excess? Are we entering a new moral sphere of living? Are we entering a new zone of post-excess economic understanding? Are we stopping our spending spree? Are we going to take up a new financial prudence? I think the church ought to be back with an answer. Now, I have tried to indicate as best I know how that I don't think this is simple. If it were simple, we wouldn't have to have the conversation. But I don't think it is simple. I think Time Magazine's raised a very interesting article. My frustration with Kurt Anderson's article in Time Magazine is he really doesn't define his terms. He does a great job, by the way, of laying out some hints about what the excess looks like. House size, you know, coming larger by a half during that same time period. You know, spending growing at such a rate that savings falls from 11% to less than 1%. Those are some pretty good signs. But then what's right? Where's the new normal, he says, we're supposed to seek to achieve? Give me a phone number. Give me a phone call, that is. I got the number. It's 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We got some good ones coming on the phone here. Let's go to Doug calling from Sellersburg, Indiana, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Doug.
Dr. Mohler, thanks for taking my call. My answer is short, and it is no, we're not at the end of excess. And the problem with defining that is excess is a relative term. Then we have to start determining who gets to set the standards and what is excess. Jesus said there's always been poor, there will always be poor, which kind of implies there will always be rich as well.
You know, Doug, I think you're really onto a hugely important point here, and it's a point that I think just has to be made, and that is, well, let me just look backwards here. You have Kurt Anderson writing in Time magazine who really dates the beginning of what he calls the age of excess to 1980. He's looking at the economic boom of the 80s, the 90s, and on until the recent Great Recession, as he calls it. And he says that there you find this age of excess. I'm going to suggest that in any given time, you're going to find an age of excess. You're going to find people having the ambition, if not the ability, to have more and more. I think Genesis 3 is the starting date for the age of excess. I think when we as human beings lost our moral sanity was in Genesis 3. And ever since Genesis 3, I just can't imagine there has been any time in human history, and I'm going to say this, and I will be glad for any historian to refute me, but they better have some evidence. I can't imagine there has been any time in human history where any civilization has said, okay, that's it. We were looking for enough. We just hit it. We got enough. We all have enough. Everybody's got enough. We don't have to work at it anymore. We don't need any more land. We don't need any more riches. We don't need anything else. This is where we need to be. This is enough. Here we are. I don't think that's ever happened. I think a part of what it means to be a fallen human race is that we have the perpetual problem of not knowing sometimes the difference between enough and too much. Now, Kurt Anderson had a three-point plan. I've really criticized it because as much as I think he's onto the right problem and at least a good way of asking the question, I don't think he really helps much with his what he calls streamlined, secularized, you know, approaches, saying that we should just return to normal and address our character defects. When those are undefined or ill-defined, that doesn't help. I have my own three-point plan, but I'm going to hold that for a minute because I want to know what you guys are thinking. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I really do have an idea to share with you from your consideration. I want to hear from more of our callers. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. David's listening on XM170. Go ahead, David.
All right, Dr. Mohler, thank you. I think anything that receives too much of our energy and too much of our attention in God's eyes is probably excess. We may not like that answer, but he wants our energy and attention. So I think that's your answer.
So anything that would distract us from spiritual priorities, anything that would compete with our allegiance to Christ, anything that would compromise our full deployment for the kingdom of God and its purposes, you would suggest that's an indication that something has reached the status that eclipses enough and is now in too much. I think David raises the issue of idolatry. He didn't use the word, but I think I can use the word and be faithful to the argument he was making. We are perpetual idolaters, and one of the central idols of the human imagination is the idol of more. I'm sure that idol goes by many names, but at the end of the day, the idol's real name is more. Of course, then we just have more and more idols, more and more and yet more. Let me know what you think. Are we in an age of excess? Are we seeing the end of the age of excess? And if it's over, what's on the other side of excess? How would we know what's just enough? The phone number 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
We're asking the question Time Magazine is asking, is this the end of excess? And we're trying to figure out how, from a Christian perspective, we can even answer the question. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. For New Albany, Indiana, Steve's waiting on the line, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Mueller, for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I believe God uses people with large amounts of money sometimes for his purposes. For instance, the way that God used Mel Gibson with his, he used $24 million of his own dollars to create The Passion of the Christ. And you know, there are very few Christians that would have or could have been able to have done that, to have the contacts to do what he did. Now, unfortunately, most Americans, if they had that same money, would only spend it on their own selfish desires.
Steve, I appreciate your call. You know, when you start looking at a lot of these things, you realize there are persons who, for one reason or another, are blessed with the enormous wealth. The bigger issue here, I think, for them is the fact that they are called to a higher standard of stewardship. You know, to those who are given more, much will be required. To those who are given much, even more is required. Jesus said, if you are faithful in little, you'll be faithful in much. If you are unfaithful in little, you'll be unfaithful in much. And, you know, Steve, just to go to your point, I think it's clear the Lord does entrust certain persons with greater wealth. That's in the Christian perspective. But, you know, one of the things that just has to rankle our Christian conscience and alert us to a problem is that there's so many people with all the wrong priorities that have so much, especially outside the kingdom of God. I mean, you start to look at the Forbes 500 or whatever it is now of the wealthiest people in the world, you look through it, you just don't see a lot of movers and shakers in the kingdom in there. It turns out that the kingdoms of this world are too often established upon riches for all the wrong reasons. Steve, appreciate your call. Let's go to Tom. What's on WFIA, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Dr. Moore, thanks for taking my call. I think excess is running up a large amount of consumer debt that you just cannot reasonably pay off in the near future.
I think that's a really good tripwire right there. I mean, absolutely. I don't think anyone can say that it is good and faithful stewardship. Number one, just to put your entire financial stability, your ability to take care of yourself and your family at risk with massive consumer debt. I just can't imagine that sane, even from a secular perspective. But from a Christian perspective, one of the bigger problems is that it puts us in a position of being indebted to someone else, who then begins to be able to at least set our priorities. And the ambition behind a lot of that, the motivation is just as Tom's indicating here, the desire for more. Folks, I'm not going to hold out on you. I said that I had a three-point plan. Kurt Anderson has his three-point plan. I didn't think it made a whole lot of sense. I don't think it's up to the question he's asking. Sometimes this is the case. People ask a big question and come back with a small answer. He asked the question, aren't we at the end of excess? He comes back and says, yes. He suggests what he calls his streamlined, secularized, three-step program for America. Number one, admit that we are powerless over addiction to easy money and cheap fossil fuel and living large, that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, believe that we can individually and collectively restore ourselves to sanity and normal living. Again, my problem is there are no definitions provided here for what sanity and normal living would look like. Then his third step, make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves and be entirely ready to remove our defects of character. Now, I mean, that should be true. We can hope that can be true of all human beings at all times, regardless of the moral challenge. I think that sounds moralistic, but not particularly helpful. So, if I think that's unhelpful, what do I think might be helpful? Let me offer a three-step way of understanding, perhaps, ways we would know that we are really seeking excess rather than being satisfied with enough. I think the first is that we must be willing to say, if I don't have enough to give, then I'm spending too much. If I'm not able to give, and I'm thinking here of the Christian responsibility to support kingdom purposes through our own investment in those purposes, our own financial giving. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. And you know, if we're in a position where we say, we can't give, we know there are important Christian causes out there, starting, first of all, with our local church. And if we're not making an impact with our funds all around the world for kingdom purposes in one way or another, I think that's a tripwire that says we're in big trouble. The second thing is, if we're not investing and saving, I think that's a big problem. The Bible honors those who are prudent and thrifty and those who invest and save. And I think that's really, really important. I think Kurt Anderson's on to a big marker of the problem here when he says, in 1980, Americans saved 11% of their income a year. Now, less than 1%. Clearly, we have a problem there. And when you put that parallel to the development of these bigger houses and all the consumer debt and consumer spending, you know, clearly there's a relationship there. Okay, so number one is if we find ourselves unable to give and exercise our stewardship as we know we ought, we know we're in trouble. There's a problem there. The second thing is, if we are not investing in saving, we need to follow the biblical example here of thrift and savings, and the understanding that it is only prudent not only to plan for a rainy day, as they often say, but to plan for future generations to take care of our families. The third issue, if we are unable to help those who need help, then we're probably spending too much. And in every one of our lives, there are people who do need help from time to time. We need to be ready and willing to help. And it may be that for most, this goes through the local church and through the ministries of the local church, which means we're helping others through funding the kind of ministries the local church would really offer of a helping nature. But we also need to help schools. We need to help Christian colleges and universities. We need to help ministries that are working with the poor and those who are clearly in a situation of urgent financial need, especially those who are victimized and who find themselves. We need to be helping people. We need to help them in ways that also reflect stewardship, not merely throwing money at a problem, but rather investing in people so that they can be self-sustaining. But at the end of the day, if we're not saving and giving and helping with our own financial means, our own income and our own wealth, then something's wrong. And if we are not able to help, to give, and to save because we're trying to spend every dollar we have to buy what we think we need, when we know in our hearts we really have what we need, then this ought to be a good test, I think, to see if we're in trouble. You know, the question, how do you know the difference between enough and too much? At the end of the day, I'm going to argue this isn't something that any one of us is well equipped to answer for ourselves. This isn't something that any couple is able to answer for ourselves. Once again, this demonstrates why we need the local church. I received a tweet message from Guy who was pointing out that excess will end only under the guiding hand of strong leadership, clergy and lady in the church who are willing to submit to each other. And I think there's a very key issue here, and that's why time and time again on this program, we come back to the local church. Local church ought to be the place where Christians together figure these things out, helping each other, praying each other into deeper faithfulness. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. We've talked about the fact that the old adage has been that the world asks the questions and the church answers them. And it's a good reminder that the church needs to be ready to answer the questions the world is asking. That's true. But that is only half true, because there are times when the church has to interrogate the world as well. There are times when we have to ask questions the world is not asking, and we really need to press that back. So how does that work? Well, I think Time Magazine asked a very good question. Are we at the end of excess? Is this crisis going to change the way we think morally, practically, pragmatically about money? Well, if they're going to ask the question, are we at the end of excess, I have to turn around and ask another question. How do you define excess? Yeah, I think that's the big problem. And that's why the world so often comes up, the secular world so often comes up with really good questions. They're just not good enough questions. Because their questions are often so superficial and so much at the surface level that they really don't get down to asking some of the most basic presuppositional questions about how we would even frame a way of understanding what's at stake. You see, I think when Kurt Anderson writes this very interesting cover story for Time magazine, he thinks that if we save more and spend less, everything will be fine. If we save more and spend less, we'll achieve a new normal which will be morally superior to the old normal. Well, I'm not arguing that there wouldn't be superior. I'm certainly going to argue, however, that it's just not enough. From a Christian worldview perspective, we need to understand that God owns everything. Stewardship for the Christian doesn't begin with a financial set of normal. It begins with a financial understanding that it all belongs to God in the first place. The whole idea of stewardship is that we actually are not owners. We are stewards. The whole idea of stewardship is something is entrusted to us that belongs to someone else. And as it is entrusted to us, we are morally, spiritually, in every way accountable for what we do with what's entrusted to us. And you know, Jesus himself told the story of those who were entrusted with riches. And then the owner came back to say, "What did you do with my riches?" You know, that's where you come to understand that the difference between enough and excess really doesn't even apply until you understand that it all belongs to God in the first place. And what we are to do as stewards is put everything that we think we own, that is everything the world says we own, everything the bank may even agree that we own, on the table and say, it all belongs to God. Now, how can I use all of this for kingdom purposes? That's the only reset. Time magazine put a reset button on the front of the magazine. Okay, I'll push that button. That's the only reset that really matters. It all belongs to God. Now, what are we as Christians going to do with it for kingdom purposes? Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.